And joining us on the book club today is Jess McHugh. Jess is the author of the book Americanon, an unexpected U.S. history in 13 best-selling books. We're going to talk a little bit about this book, the 13 books that Jess features. And let me tell you a little bit about Jess. She has a very big background. She is a journalist. She's a writer, researcher whose work has appeared across a variety of national and international publications, including The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The Nation, Time, The Paris Review Daily, The Guardian, The New Republic, New York's Magazine, The Cut, Fortune, Village Voice, The Believer, and Lapham's Quarterly, among others. She's also reported stories from four continents on a range of historical and cultural topics, from present-day Liverpool punks to a profile of 1960s activists in Greenwich Village. Jess, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, before we carry on about talking about the book here, what caught my eye right away when you would have said that you wrote a piece about present-day Liverpool punks and being a big Beatles fan and Liverpool guys. I just was curious about that story.
Sure. Yeah, that story was a few years ago now. I want to say 2016. It was really fascinating. Essentially, there's kind of been a revival of the punk movement, so to speak, in Liverpool, especially following the kind of economic crisis of following 2008 and some of the austerity measures in Europe, and kind of the unemployment among young people led to this revival of the punk scene. And so I traveled to Liverpool and spent a few days with them and interviewed some of these young musicians. And it was just fascinating. And then speaking to, you know, some of the actual original punks or those punk journalists back in the 60s to see kind of the connection between the two really struck me about the nature of our discontent.
Tell us a little bit about, because this book that we're going to talk about, Americanon, is, by the way, am I saying the title correctly?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. An Unexpected U.S. History in 13 Bestseller Books. These are, it's to put it mildly, very old books, but books that have been around forever. Just about everybody knows about them. So at what point did you decide, you know what, because I know you've done research, you've done a lot of historical pieces, and so at what point did you say, you know what, I think I'm going to write a book about some of the books that defined our country?
It's a great question. You know, it started with Webster's Dictionary and a fascination with Noah Webster, because I had been surprised to learn that, you know, the man who wrote what is essentially the American Dictionary had these really high hopes for this text. And he hoped that the dictionary would become this kind of linguistic, cultural rallying cry, and that American English would one day become as different from British English as you know, German was from Dutch. And he was this born-again Christian and this nationalist, and that was also a big part of his project for the dictionary. I remember being so surprised, because the dictionary is one of those books that we take for granted. It seems like the kind of book that was designed by a committee. And so it made me think, I wonder if there are other books like these, you know, books that are bestsellers, are instructional, but are actually doing something a bit more profound. And the more I looked into it, the more I found that there were, in fact, many, many books like this. And that's what got me started.
The number 13, is that just something that you just said, I have to stop here because my editor is telling me that? Or was it because of the 13 colonies? What was it?
You know, great question. It's a little bit of both. I love that it ended up being 13 because of the 13 colonies and because I kind of like lucky number 13. But it was sort of that. It took me about a year of research of, you know, looking at the numbers, because I really wanted to rely on the data of what sold the best and what kind of influenced the most people, as well as interviewing academics and looking through archives. So after a year of research, I kept trying to narrow it down to 10, but I just couldn't get to 10. So I ended up at 13.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist, recent author of Americanon, An Unexpected U.S. History in 13 Best-Selling Books. When the book opens up, when you're talking a little bit about the Farmer's Almanac, and that's the first book that you feature, and I thought it was interesting. In fact, I had to go back to check to see if we still had a copy of ours because of that hole in the corner.
Yes, yes, the hole in the corner, and they still drill that hole in the corner every year. The idea with the almanac is that it should be able to, you know, hang on a hook in the kitchen or in your shed. It's kind of there whenever you need it. And that kind of speaks to the nature of so many of these books, that they're not sacred, they're not heavy, they're meant to be, other than the dictionary, they're often meant to be kind of carried around and used frequently. And the almanac is one of those books that has had this staying power. This particular one started in 1792. It's published annually since then and still sells about 3 million copies every year.
So one of the things that you mentioned in the book is that it is the publication, the selling of this book, it's bigger than the circulation of the New York Times.
Yes, I was so shocked to learn that, because you would maybe not think that information about sunrise and tide times would be as vital for people in their day-to-day lives. But I think it speaks to the kind of enduring poignancy of this kind of book. And we might not be using it in the same way that a farmer in 1792 was, but I think we seem to need it for something else, which is to say, kind of a reminder of some of our agrarian roots, or just this call to observe the natural world. That's what I personally love about the almanac. They're kind of reminders about harvest moons and eclipses and different kinds of insects and plants. And I think that's very rare, especially in our kind of internet world.
Tell us a little bit about how is the almanac put together now? Because it must have been a lot of work back in 1792. But now that people have Google at their fingertips, the internet, people rarely go to the library. How is that book put together now? Do you know?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's kind of fascinating, because they say, or they told me when I went to visit their offices, that they still use the same method for calculating the weather that Robert B. Thomas, their founding editor, did in the 18th century. They, of course, use, you know, meteorological equipment as well, but they still have his, you know, so-called secret formula in this black box in Dublin, and I was not allowed to see inside it, so I can't tell you exactly what's in there.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist and author Jess McHugh. She is the author of the book Americanon, an unexpected U.S. history in 13 best-selling books. You mentioned moons and tides a little while ago, and I was fascinated by the story, and I'm not sure if it was in the book or you mentioned it in one of your interviews, but the fact that Lincoln, when he was a lawyer, referred to the almanac and stated his case because of something that happened in that courtroom.
Oh, yes, this is a fascinating story, and I think it speaks to the ways in which so many of these books intersect with American history in very surprising ways. So, you know, Abraham Lincoln, when he was a young lawyer, he was defending a murder suspect, and the chief witness said, "Oh, I saw this person commit this crime, even though it was nighttime, because I saw him by the light of the moon." And Lincoln goes to what is believed to be the Old Farmer's Almanac and looks up and sees that, in fact, there was no moon that night. And in this way, he was able to discount this person's testimony and to eventually win his case, which is just incredible.
We have 13 books to cover here, so we're going to move on. But if we have time, we'll come back to the Farmer's Almanac. The next one is, and you talked a little bit about it already, Noah Webster's dictionary. And a lot of people think, my gosh, how do you put together a book about words, thinking up all these words that we use in our language? And Noah Webster wanted to establish, you correct me if I'm wrong, kind of a national language, something that all Americans could refer to by using this book?
Oh, exactly that. You know, he really wanted to have this new American language. At some points, he was so radical in his belief in that American English should be written as it was spoken, that he wanted the word women to be spelled W-I-M-M-E-N, for instance. And so these beliefs really sprang from his kind of his patriotism and his beliefs that in order to have a tradition of letters, to have a tradition of history, to have, you know, really an empire, a civilization, Americans needed their own language, and they needed to have a shared language. And the dictionary, for him, was really kind of the main tool for this goal.
As we know, there are constantly changes in our vocabulary, in our words. What used to mean something maybe 20 years ago is something completely different now. And, you know, now we have words like Google. I'm trying to think of something else, but does the Webster, Merriam-Webster company, do they automatically put in these new words, and who decides what these words are going to be added?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating process. It's essentially a combination of people asking for a word, the number of usages they can find in written text, including text online. And so they add in new words every year. Just this year, for instance, they added the term social distancing, which I think was not a verb that many people were thinking of pre-pandemic times. And I think it speaks to the ways in which language does continue to evolve, and at the same time that there are, to a certain extent, gatekeepers. There was another writer, Gretchen McCullough, who said, you know, having a word in the dictionary almost seems to sanctify it as real in some way. And that's why so many people will write in asking that their favorite word be added to the dictionary each year.
You know, it's interesting. I used to remember watching my grandfather, and he would be sitting down and take a dictionary and he'd just read it. And I'm going, why would someone want to read the dictionary? But that was his way of learning new words and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I actually did that myself.
Okay.
As a child, I thought it would make me seem smart. I thought it would make me smart. And mostly what it did was I would just mispronounce a lot of words. I remember distinctly seeing a crosswalk sign and saying to my parents, oh, look, some pedestrians. And it's still a running joke in my household.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist, and she is the author of the book Americanon, Jess McHugh, An Unexpected U.S. History in 13 Best-Selling Books. The next book that you cover is Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. And I remember going, I think, to a garage sale or a used bookstore, and I saw a copy of this, and I thought, wow, this is really old. I got to get it for me. I don't know what the print date was, but that was at the point where I would find a penny or a coin, if it said 1950-something, I thought it was really old and rare.
I love that. Yes, this book is, you know, one of the kind of great classics for American history and for, I would argue, even kind of the earliest self-help book. What surprised me about it is, you know, Franklin's story of kind of being a self-made man and a printer has become so well known. I think every school child in the U.S. learns some version or other of it. What I was surprised to learn in my research was that he wrote this book at a time of kind of personal and political failure. He's struggling with the kind of rumblings of the American Revolution. He doesn't get this job that he wants, and he starts writing it almost to kind of preemptively correct the record of his life. And he's this wonderful PR person, salesman, who's both kind of selling himself and selling what he sees as his vision of America.
Benjamin Franklin, at least in this autobiography and what you say in your book, he comes out to be, we know him as one of the founding fathers, but the way that I kind of figured out by reading your book and looking at this biography in just a bit is that Ben Franklin was a performer.
Exactly. He was this very talented performer, and I think that's something we forget. I mean, all of the different roles he played throughout his life, a diplomat, a scientist, a business person, a scholar. And I think one of the stories that sticks out is it's, you know, 1776, and he gets sent to France to get funds and a treaty, hopefully to kind of bankroll the war. And knowing that he won't be able to match the French aristocracy on their terms, he wears these kind of very simple woolen clothes. He puts on his spectacles. He even wears this marten fur cap that he bought from Canada. And people are so taken with him in Paris. This is the kind of frontiersman that they imagine Americans to be, that everybody is charmed by him. I mean, women start buying wigs called coiffure à la Franklin, meant to look like his hat. He's just a total hit. And I think it really speaks to his kind of chameleon powers.
You mentioned that when he wrote this, he was going through some troubles, and I think he was a widower at this time. Is that correct?
Not quite yet. I think the main issue in his family at the time was that he was estranged from his son, and the autobiography itself is actually written as a letter to his son. And in some ways, he seems to be kind of bridging some familial gaps, especially as he's in Europe and his family's back in America.
At what point did people who read this book, and then, as you mentioned, the French kind of looked and said, well, this is the way Americans are, which sometimes, you know, even today, we have people who come out here to El Paso and they expect it to be the Marty Robbins ballad of Dusty Old El Paso and gunfighters. So books and good performers like Mr. Franklin actually set the stage for everybody else.
Right, exactly. And it's kind of funny because Franklin's autobiography actually comes out in French before it comes out in English. And I think it speaks to just how much his ideas were being exported. And yeah, exactly. As somebody who I live in Paris, I often do get that of, you know, where's your horse and your shotgun? Like, this is still, to a certain extent, people's vision of Americans.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist Jess McHugh. Jess has just released a book, Americanon, an unexpected U.S. history in 13 best-selling books. This last year and a half, Jess, as you are well aware, has been very different because of the pandemic. And a lot of people who have children could not send their children to school. So a lot of them turned to homeschooling, something that is in the roots of American, I guess, because a lot of Americans learned from home. And the next book that you feature, The McGuffey Reader, that was something that you found almost in every school book, every schoolhouse, whether it be Little House on the Prairie that we watch on TV or Christie, anything like that, The McGuffey Reader is right there.
Yes, I mean, the McGuffey readers were just ubiquitous. I mean, to this day, I think they've taught more Americans how to read than any other book. They sold something like 122 million copies, I believe it is. And again, what's fascinating about them is that they come from this man, William Holmes McGuffey, who was kind of a child of the frontier. And what he was able to do was to kind of put American-ness on the page in a way that resonated for a lot of people about, you know, frontier values and farm animals. It also was kind of deeply inflected by his own Presbyterian theology and his beliefs as a minister. And it very much became the book both for homeschooling and for the kind of budding common school movement of the mid-19th century, early 19th century.
You can still find it available, correct?
Yes. And what I was surprised to learn that, in fact, many kind of more conservative Christian homeschoolers still use this text, if not exclusively, as kind of a central part of their schooling because of its kind of particular theological roots. And it still is being printed by a Christian publisher, and it's very much available.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist Jess McHugh. Jess is the author of the recently released book, Americanon, an Unexpected U.S. History in 13 Best-Selling Books. The next one, I was wondering what kind of, it's one of the best-selling books, but I was wondering what kind of backlash did it get from feminists, because it's Treatise on Domestic Economy by Catherine Beecher and the American Woman's Home. And apparently, they believe that a woman was supposed to be at home, and she had to do it to the best of her ability to elevate the society's respect for, because as we've heard some people say, you know, a woman's home is a reflection of who she is.
Yes, exactly. And that's very much an idea that dates from this time and from the Beecher sisters. And they were really just one of many, you know, books, one of many women and also men kind of promulgating this same message. At the time, because the kind of cult of domesticity, as kind of historians have dubbed it, was so popular, there was not a lot of backlash to the first book in the 1840s. It was very much accepted. And in some ways, her notion that American women could shape the future of the nation by the way that they raised their children was, I think some people have argued, empowering to a certain extent. But by the time you get to the late 1860s, early 70s, when she and her sister Harriet Beecher Stowe write this next kind of installment, the tides are starting to change. You know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton is talking about women's right to vote at the same time. Even their younger half-sister, Isabella Beecher Hooker, is saying, we need to be shifting our focus here. But they kind of cling to this older, more traditional view of women's role in the home and in the nation.
The next book is about etiquette in society, in business, in politics, and at home. And what I understand, too, is that this book was popular among immigrants because they wanted to know how to act like an American, how to be like an American. But again, this is something that, well, what somebody said when I mentioned this to them was the fact that, well, these were manners and etiquette that were being used in rich households, rich homes. And so passing them on to a farm worker or a farmer or somebody who was a homesteader didn't really mean much.
Yes, exactly. So it kind of, I would say a little surprising about her book was that, you know, Emily Post was this wealthy Manhattanite who kind of came from the upper crust. And so she and the people to whom she addressed her book, which were her kind of peers in Manhattan, didn't really need this information because, of course, they were raised by their governesses and what have you to kind of know the manners. And I think the people who were most interested in it were, you see, the great migration from country to city happening in the early 20th century. And so people who are coming from the farms and don't know how to maybe behave at a dinner party or later on to have cocktails with the boss, for them, it's a guide to this new life that they're trying to have and to a way to kind of climb the social ladder by learning the social cues that kind of people in the upper crust, so to speak, have been raised to have.
Someone asked me when they found out that I was going to speak with you, wondering if the books were in any particular order or did you just decide to do it that way?
I decided to do it chronologically. I tried a few different orders kind of over the years of writing it, and I think it made the most sense because it kind of allowed me to track the evolution of so many of these ideas that you see pop up again and again, and it was interesting to trace the roots of an idea such as, you know, the importance of agricultural life or the notions of meritocracy or the self-made man or whatever it means to have American manners. And so I found that it made the most sense to kind of start from the beginning and work toward the present day.
I'm going to skip over the Carnegie book for just a minute in case we run out of time. But with the popularity of cooking shows that we have now on TV and on social media, tell us about Betty Crocker's Picture Cookbook.
Yes, so Betty Crocker, I think unbeknownst to many, including me until doing this research, was in fact a fictional character. She was invented by accident by what would become the General Mills Corporation. They had made this ad that was a puzzle that women could send in for a prize, and they were surprised that all of these women sent in questions about recipes and why their dough was lumpy. And the ad men, not knowing what to sign, they didn't want to sign their own name to it, thinking that the women would not kind of trust their opinions, decided to come up with this new name, Betty, because they thought it sounded wholesome, and Crocker for a recently retired executive. And the Betty Crocker character just took off. I mean, she had radio shows and TV shows and cookbooks. And, you know, by 1945, she was named the second most influential woman just after Eleanor Roosevelt. And her cookbook becomes the best-selling cookbook in American history, and it's really about American manners and customs and also, again, you know, what it means to be a good wife, a good mother, and a good American woman.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist Jess McHugh. Jess is the author of the book Americanon, an Unexpected U.S. History in 13 best-selling books. Going right along, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask, by Dr. Rubin, and this was something that, in a way, kind of raised questions because this was before Dr. Ruth. This was before any of these talk shows or books were available.
Yes, exactly. And I think in many ways, Dr. Rubin kind of becomes the archetype for this sort of sexpert, so to speak, like Dr. Ruth, although I think Dr. Ruth does a kind of much more thorough job in terms of her own medical background. But you see, Dr. Rubin, his book is this huge smash hit. I think he has something like 100 million readers, and he's for the first time going on talk shows and going on late night TV and, you know, talking to celebrities. And it really is kind of the first rumblings of what we see now with so many sex columns and podcasts and this whole kind of empire of sex advice.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist and author Jess McHugh. She is the author of the book Americanon, An Unexpected U.S. History, and 13 best-selling books. We went over the 7 habits of highly effective people. We passed it over, I meant, but that's the last one here on the list by Stephen Covey. And this was something that was very popular in the 1989 and into the 90s.
Yes, exactly. I wanted to kind of go through to the end of the 20th century, and I think a lot of what Covey has to say about success and about business have really continued well into our century. He kind of coins terms such as win-win and paradigm shift. And again, he's emblematic of a certain type of self-help literature that still exists now, or business management literature, I should say, that's all about kind of focusing on what you can control and bettering yourself. And to a certain extent, I think it works, especially in terms of within a corporate structure. And it also grows more complicated, especially in the kind of shifting dynamics that we see in the workplace now. So I'd be curious to see, he's no longer alive, but what he would have to say about our current working climate.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist Jess McHugh. She is the author of the book Americanon, An Unexpected U.S. History, in 13 best-selling books. Jess, at what point did you, or did your publisher, your editor tell you, okay, that's enough, as far as researching each book? I know that you probably had to do a little bit more for some and some less for the others, but still, that's a lot of work.
It was a ton of work. It was really just a question of time at a certain point where they said, you know, we got to cut you off. You got to start writing, cut you off on the research. And so, but it was a very long process of interviews and research. And I think I had about, you know, at least 100 or 200 pages of notes almost per chapter. So it was quite a process, but I love research and I love interviewing. So it was a real pleasure as well.
Well, congratulations on releasing this awesome book. It's available in audio version as well. And is there a web page that people can go to find out more about you and this book?
Sure. So you can go to my web page, which is just jessmchugh.com, M-C-H-U-G-H, or if you search the book Americanon, you should be able to find places to buy it near you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. We've been visiting with award-winning journalist Jess McHugh. Jess' latest book is called Americanon, An Unexpected U.S. History in 13 Best-Selling Books.